Welcome to Everything But The Tip, the podcast that bucks the trend of the mainstream golf content being churned out by the masses. Presented by the co-founders of Smart Golf and Fitness, we're on a mission to guide golfers towards genuine improvement. No swing tips, no shortcuts, we're anti-instant gratification. Join us as we navigate the complexities of the game, offering insights on how to truly excel in golf by embracing the challenges and breaking free from the usual quick fix mentality. Hey everyone, we're back. And today we're going to start off with a question. Have you ever experienced those moments on the course where you're hitting the ball exactly where you want, only to be followed by a big miss on the next tee box? Or even those rain sessions where you're striking the ball perfectly until suddenly a wild shot appears out of nowhere and you just can't seem to find it again. Tommy, can you relate to that?
Oh, I thought that was rhetorical, or maybe we were taking an early caller. But me personally, I experienced that last Friday. You saw it firsthand. I had a very nice front nine going, and then a very uncharacteristic tee shot came out. Experienced that a couple of times on Sunday, unfortunately. And to be perfectly honest, I really haven't had a round of golf where that didn't creep in. So,
fair enough. And I think you're obviously not alone. But today, we're going to try to unravel the mystery behind these inconsistencies and not only shed light on why golfers often feel like they have multiple swings, but we're going to prove that they don't. And as we create clarity on the all but too common experience, it will allow us, which is our main objective today, to discuss our overall philosophy when it comes to making swing changes. Specifically, we're going to focus on our approach we use at Smart Golf and Fitness Instruction when we decide to do mechanical surgery on golf swings.
All right. So, I mean, do you want to jump right into the philosophy itself, or do you want to give us a little bit of background on, like, how you came, we came about, how the philosophy came to fruition before jumping right into it?
Yeah, no, I think that would make a lot of sense to talk about the origin without completely going into detail on what it is. But it's an important question. And, well, full transparency, in the beginning of my career.
At Bally Bunyan?
Yeah. Even before then, PGA National. And, you know, I hate to admit it, but it's the truth. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. I had no idea what the hell to teach. And I really didn't have a definitive answer on why I decided to go in a specific direction with a student. I mean, I could see what the ball was doing. You know, if it was slicing, hooking, et cetera, I understood the ball flight laws. And like a majority of range coaches, you know, did at the time, I did my best to manipulate posture. I did my best to manipulate grip and alignment.
Baga!
PGA.
PGA, baby.
You know, and of course I'd have my periodic success. But, you know, I was also just confused at the time. And, you know, I can still relate to green coaches today or coaches early in their career. I mean, we had all these different ideas of swing methodologies. We had, you know, ranging from stack and tilt, one plane, two plane, natural golf, A swing, upper core, lower core, and the list goes on and on and on. And, you know, to top it off, I don't know if you remember, but we had that Arnold Palmer commercial at the time. You remember what that said?
Swing your swing, baby.
Swing your swing. Yeah, too, to this day, I know that I feel like there was a movement like on the teaching blogs and stuff, and everyone's just like, yeah, just swing your swing, you know? And it's like, okay, well, I couldn't completely unpack that because, you know, Arnold Palmer was easy to say. His swing, you know, was a little unorthodox. So he's like, hey, if I can get the job done like this, then you can get the job done your way. But what I think he failed to at least acknowledge, and maybe the message that might have been a little bit misguiding, is that although there was some, you know, unorthodox movements in his golf swing, there was a lot that he did that a lot of really good players did. So we'll also discuss
some
that
commonalities.
Today. Exactly.
So it's kind of like if you go to a ski hill or whatever. I mean, a lot of people can make it to the bottom of the hill, but those that make it down more efficiently have some similarities in terms of how they use their edges, what kind of position they are. They don't have their arms flailing out to the side. I mean, so you can call yourself a skier, but a lot of skiers look a lot different.
No doubt. So, you know, to move forward on all of that, you take into consideration all these different swing methodologies. You know, you've got the Arnold Palmer, swing your own swing. And you throw in the fact that a majority of students I would see, although they had plenty, you know, had the ability to hit plenty of bad shots, they, of course, would throw in the occasional great shot. Only for me at the time to look back at the video and say, hey, let's look at the difference between the good and the bad one. And they were virtually identical. So at that point, it was like, man, like, if this swing's already capable of hitting good shots, he just showed it to me. You know, what's the main objective here? Because obviously, what's the number one goal? What's the number one answer when we ask a student sitting across the table, hey, why are you here? What's your goal?
Well, we heard a lot of answers, but one of the top ones has to be, I'd like to be a little more consistent and hit the golf ball a little further.
100%. You know, almost every single time, want to be consistent. And, you know, I get it because a lot of students have witnessed themselves hit good shots, you know, therefore demonstrating that they are capable, and they wonder why they can't do it more often. And I will assure you, on a high handicapper's golf swing, it's not because they're mentally weak.
They are consistent. They're just consistently bad.
Right. It's like, why you should actually probably be more surprised when you hit it well. And I'm not even joking there. So taking all of this into consideration, I really had to take a step back and figure out, what the hell is my goal here as a coach? And what actually really leads to consistency? If that is the goal, like, you know, what does that mean? What does it take to get there? So I will say where I started was I started looking at the top money earners in the world. So you start to look at the list on the PGA Tour, whether it's top 25, top 50, whatever. And I just said, hey, let's just start with a 100% list. What do 100% of these players do?
I remember when we started to do that kind of as an exercise, yep, with the staff and everything like that, and everybody we brought on and hired, you know, we had them go through and make their own list, and then we would compare that list to the one that we had already kind of created. But like, so we had the 100% list.
Yep. And to this day, still not finished. But the reality is that list isn't extremely long. But if you want to highlight a few of the obvious ones, well, they all stand on 2 feet. You know, they all hold the club with 2 hands. You know, there is some hip rotation. There's some torso rotation in all golf swings in the backswing. There's always going to be a little bit of bend, you know, some bend in their trail arm. You know, one commonality that holds true to good players that's a little less obvious is that their arc on the backswing is wider than their arc on the downswing. Okay, so we've heard a lay, we've heard a narrowing, right?
Width, extension, and things like that.
Exactly. That's a commonality. All really good ball strikers do that. Then you go through the hitting zone. Yep, there's all of them have a little bit of hip. They have some amount of hip rotation, some amount of torso rotation. You know, there's some degree of shaft lean. But the point is, I didn't just go there and end there. I said, cool, let me try to generate this list of 100%. Wasn't that long. But there were some areas worth highlighting and being aware of. Because once you know that there's a movement or a position or an action in which all top players are doing, well, it's probably a good idea to make sure that's a part of your objective and what you're looking for in other swings. But where I spent more time was, all right, what do 90% of players do? Obviously, there's exceptions. There's exceptions to positions. There's exceptions to overall swings. There's actually not a lot of exceptions when it comes to impact dynamics. You know, TrackMan, we won't go into that today. Low point, dynamic loft, tack angle. That's probably closer to the 100 percentile list. But you know, that's where I wanted to live. And that could have been from what the first move off the golf swing looks like. We've hinted at what the positions were, the P's, P1, you know, P2, so on. And I just started to look, what are most of these players doing? You know, and then when there was an exception, we're not going to go too deep into that. I just wanted to know why there was an exception. And a lot of the times it was physical. But anyway, so that's where I started my search on this overall swing philosophy. And then at the same time, or actually even earlier in my career, I read this book. I suggest any pro read it. And honestly, even if you're a student of the game and someone listening to this podcast, read it. Nothing bad is going to come from it. And if anything, it might educate you in a manner that allows you to be a more complimentary student to the process. But it was Swing Like a Pro, written by Ralph Mann. And he basically just creates a scenario to where if you were a perfect specimen, if you were a robot, you didn't have any major physical issues, your body functioned the way that, you know, the anatomy was intended to, would there be one most efficient way to swing? Well, the conclusion was yes, right? Because if there wasn't, then what the hell are you teaching? What are the ideals? Why do something?
How do they test golf balls?
Right.
You know?
You know, iron barn. But, you know, and so that was eye-opening to me, right? So finally, you take all that into consideration. And, you know, I wanted to answer, all right, no, let me say this. As I continued trying to develop what my goal was as a coach, it goes back to really diving deep into a swing that looked identical on video, but produced two different results, and why some swings misses were way bigger than other swings. So I don't want to dive too deep into our mechanical philosophy yet, because we're gonna talk a little bit more before you know that question's asked. But other part of what I want to discuss, which you didn't ask, but it's like, why is that even important? Why is it important?
Why is that even important?
why is it important for our students? Why is it important? Because, you know, it's a step in our process. It's not as long-winded as this, but we do make it a point to logically explain what our swing change philosophy is on a mechanical level.
Yeah, every assessment, somebody comes in, and that's a step in the process to be able to explain that, so they have that understanding after they come back down from the physical screen. So are we ready to go there yet, or you got a little more insight as to,
yeah, obviously, you know, I'm looking at the template stuff, we put together. So we try to have this easy flow as possible for our listeners to make it as solid experience as possible. Yeah, no, let's get into it. I'll talk about why it's important after we explain, you know, what it actually is. But you know more than anyone, Tommy, that in order for us to best communicate what our swing change philosophy is, we always must first ask what we consider a pretty thought-provoking question. And it goes hand in hand, right in line with the scenario I just predicted. But it's the same question we ask every single client that walks through the door. What truly is the difference between a tour caliber swing producing consistent preferred results versus an everyday amateur golf swing producing less consistently preferred results on a mechanical level? Or if you wanted to simplify that, you could say, what truly is the difference, Tommy, between your good shots and bad shots on a mechanical level? Why can the same golf swing produce the good and bad ones mechanically?
Again, is that rhetorical, or should I give it away?
Hey, however you want to provide entertainment to the audience, you know what? Go ahead and do whatever you want to do.
Well, I think we should just get into it. I mean, that background took a little while, so we should just talk about the timing equation, man. We should just get right into it.
What was the word you said?
Timing.
Timing.
There it is. Timing equation.
Timing. So there it is. That's the beginning of our explanation of what our swing change philosophy is. You know, I worked with a pretty cool piece of technology, advanced motion measurement, 12 sensors, goes all over the body. You've got to go through this digitization process, basically showing the computer where the body is in its space, where the joints are, and it can measure anything you could ever want to know biomechanically in the golf swing. Well, what was really fascinating was that when you measured this biomechanical data and someone hit a good shot, someone hit a bad shot, the biomechanical data was virtually identical. So that was an aha moment for me. It was like, okay, wait a minute. Two different results, but the biggest movements, we call them macro movements, were identical. So what the hell was the difference? Well, we decided here at Smart Golf to blanket that answer as timing. So in this case, in this example, as we explain it to our members, explain it to you as listeners, timing is the moment the club strikes the ball. So,
what kind of answers do we normally get from clients? Like all sorts, right? You know, they're talking about swing plane. They're talking about, you know, how many cocktails did I have, you know, before the round started. You know,
yeah, no, that's good. It could be pressure, stuff. Right? So that's why we're very specific to say what's the difference mechanically. I'm not saying there aren't external influences.
Kind of like what we saw at the end of the U.S. Open last week.
Potentially. I'm curious to see what Rory would say, but we can only imagine how much pressure he was under.
Sure.
Will pressure play an influence in your timing in golf swing? Yeah. Will alcohol play an influence in your timing? Probably. Some, maybe even better. You know, I might be guilty of that. But the reality is you need to accept that the more timing you have, well, the more those influences are going to play a role. So our philosophy is still the same and the logic behind it is still the same. So to take that a step further, we go ahead and we create a discuss an analogy to all of our clients. We say, hey, we like to think of the golf swing like a math equation of variables that equals timing. So for example, a tour caliber swing might be A plus B plus C plus D equals timing. Very simple, very straightforward, very easy to solve. Still has timing to it, but pretty straightforward. Higher handicapper's golf swing might be A plus B plus C plus D plus E plus F plus G plus whatever other compensation they have equals timing.
Sounds complicated. We're going back to the Pythagorean theorem?
Maybe.
Okay.
But it really isn't complicated. The question I always ask is after I explain their equation, I go, can you still solve that equation?
Absolutely.
Well, those are your good shots.
It takes a doctorate.
Yeah. Yeah, some players could be credited to their athleticism when they come in here with some pretty janky golf swings and are able to perform at a certain high level. I can assure you, if you weren't a good athlete with that golf swing, you would not have, you know, found the success that you've had. We see it all the time. But imagine how much easier the game could be for you. So then we take it a step further and we actually give a physical demonstration. And, you know, I'll get up there and I'll say, hey, let's just talk about the first move off the ball. It's the takeaway. Let's assume we have five variables. There might be more, might be less. Doesn't matter. There's not less. But we've got our upper body, so our torso, our arms, our hands, our club, and our lower body. Five variables. Then we demonstrate a takeaway. And at that point, you know, it's coined as the one-piece takeaway. I bring the club back. I don't have a lot of rotation in the hands. Bringing it straight back. I'm doing a very good job at allowing my torso, arms, hands, and club kind of working as one unit. And I literally ask them, I go, hey, what are my hands doing? They're like, eh, not much. Okay, cool. I go, could I make the argument that these five variables are working as one? And they're like, okay, sure. And I go, so then I paint another picture and I demonstrate in another manner and I kind of have them work individually. So I'll rip the club face wide open. So club face is open. Hands are rotating. I disconnect my arms, I over-rotate my hips, and I try to paint a picture of five variables working independently. And then I ask them a question. I say, hey, if I'm compensated here, do I increase the likelihood of being compensated later in the golf swing? The logical answer is yes. Is it guaranteed? No, not necessarily. You can screw up your takeaway and still save yourself. But most cases, more times than not, that's not the case. If you're compensated here and you've got five variables working independently, you're increasing the likelihood of more compensation. Well, then we fast forward to what we consider one of the most important positions of the golf swing. We call it delivery. This is where the club is parallel to the ground prior to strike. There's only so many positions you can be in. You can either be on plane, which we define as swinging towards your intended target. You can be above it, aka over the top, or you can be below it. In all three of those positions, you can either have an open, closed, or square club face.
So there's nine combinations there you could have?
If you really wanted to oversimplify it, yeah.
You got me in a math mindset, so I just keep on, like, you know, trying to add stuff together and multiply it. But anyway.
Well, I know we can get the listeners to follow and understand because I know you understand it today, and if you can, you know, anyone can. you know, but that being said, you know, I put it in delivery, and I put the club face square. You know, some of you guys might not know what that means, but you should. And I put it on plan, and I go, well, this is if I'm trying to create a scenario that is going to make my timing the easiest in order to hit it straight, which one of those positions are you going to choose? Well, 100% of the time, they go, well, probably the one closest to playing with a square face. I go, yeah, bingo. Because if you're overplaying with an open face, can you hit it straight?
Yes, you can.
You actually can. But in order to do it, you are going to have
elite athleticism or a lot of compensation.
Yes, the answer I was looking for, both of those are true. Our last second manipulation through the hitting zone. Think about it. When the club's traveling the fastest and you're in a reactive state where you've got to create extra motion due to where the club was out of position, well, yeah, that's hard to repeat. And when you're under pressure, it's going to get worse, I promise you. You know, there's this book out there talking about choking in general. We won't go into that today. But they say choking doesn't exist. You're a victim of your weakest link. Right? So under pressure, the weakest link is going to break. So therefore, if you have extra compensations that are resulting in last second manipulation to the hitting zone, aka the flip, all you guys have heard of the flip, I'm sure, if you're listening to this podcast. Well, in a lot of cases, guys, that flip's required. It's the same reason you hit good and bad shots.
I remember I was in the club championship, the Chili's flight 2 years ago, and I had a pretty commanding lead after 18 holes, and I was coming down the last nine-hole stretch, and carts started to, like, gather around us and stuff. I was like, all right, this is pretty cool. Did I get a little bit of a butterfly in the stomach? I'm like, yeah, you know. So I got a little, you know, excited about what was going on there. hit two good shots in a row and then proceeded to hit a real, real skanky shot. And one guy's like, hey, man, I've been in this position plenty of times. Relax. We're just here to watch. Blah, blah. I was like, dude, you're giving me way too much credit because I could be hitting that shot if I was, you know, 20 over par in last place. I could be hitting that shot if I was in first place. I could be hitting that shot if I'm playing here all by myself or if you're here. So appreciate the vote of confidence, but it had nothing to do with you standing behind me. So,
and it's the truth. Not most people aren't, you know, aware enough to think of that as a reality, but that is the truth. But anyway, so yeah, that's our swing change philosophy. Our swing change philosophy is ultimately solidifying the movement patterns and variables that should exist while minimizing the ones that shouldn't. Getting your club as close to plane and square in delivery with the least amount of manipulation to get to that spot in order to reduce the need for last second manipulation. You know, I kind of got sidetracked there a little bit. I just wanted to say, like, you know, you start to look at the timing equation, extra variables, and we highlighted being over plane with an open face and where you can still have the ability to hit it straight. And I just wanted to say, like, yeah, what you'd have to do is stop turning, stand up out of posture, cast the club. I feel like I can use these terms now if you've been following the podcast because we've talked about these swing characteristics. Add the flip, have terrible low point control, right? Now, good athletes, which we highlighted, they can, you know, if they're hitting a lot of balls, that's where if you're listening to this and you're kind of been dumbfounded in the past where you've been the guy that can go to the range, grab a couple of balls, hit them all. By the end of it, feel like you got better. You know, you may even be playing that evening or the next morning and play well because you went to the range and noticed that there's a pattern to where when you're not able to hit as many balls, you don't play as well. But you don't actually get better year to year. You just have good rounds, but you've been bouncing around as the same player year in and year out. Because all you've been doing is playing a game and getting your timing better at some points throughout the season, but you haven't been doing shit to increase your potential and your ceiling, right? That's the majority of all golfers.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that as well. You know, it's a relatively thorough answer for those of the, you know, the players that come on in, the people that come in to see us and say, hey, I feel like I've got a number of different swings, things like that. So it's realistically, you don't have a number of different swings. We use K-Vest and Sportsbox AI right now and things like that. So again, those pieces of technology are, you know, just essential because they help us see things that we can't see with the naked eye. So I remember early on in my career using the K-Vest, taking somebody through an assessment prior to us being together. But just, I want to see how, you know, the body moved, obviously. And this guy was intent in the fact that, you know, when I told him, you know, and broke down what his kinematic sequence was and some of the highlights of what we found there, he was like, no, all right, I can do it. And I was like, what do you mean you can do it? We're going to put together a program to help you do it. He's like, no, let's start now. I'm like, well, okay. I didn't have that many clients at that time, so I had plenty of time. And we spent the next hour him trying to improve his sequencing, just, you know, staring at the video, play it again, let me see it, and trying to do that. You know, I tried to give the guy the insight that, you know, that's not going to be that easy because we had looked at the physical screen prior. We had highlighted some of those things, but he believed himself. He believed he was, you know, the athlete that he necessarily wasn't. So we spent an entire hour, and then finally he was like, all right, I'm tired. When do I see you next? You know, so it's like that's why we did all the episodes prior to kind of just give you some insight as to what are all these different swing characteristics. So these swing characteristics that we highlighted over the previous episodes are all those variables that you just put together. Yes, you can get into a really, really awkward or undesirable, you know, backswing position, takeaway position, you know, almost delivery position. And then all of a sudden now you have to introduce all these things that we've talked about previously that, you know, happen in golf swings. Some of them are desirable, some of them are undesirable. But again, that's where it becomes important to know why they happen, physical or just mechanical or lack of just understanding what you're trying to do in the golf swing. Secondly, you have to understand that you just can't take away somebody's early extension. If you take away somebody's early extension, on the way down, and they need that to be able to hit that shot right, probably not going to see that guy for a little while if that's your first approach to their golf swing. So the cause and effect is huge here in terms of knowing what variables are important. Secondly, you have to know what's the hierarchy, what happens, and then the cause and effect. The hierarchy and the cause and effect are key to know, all right, if I change this, then I know that X, Y, and Z are probably going to happen. If I change this, you know, so that's the real big key of being able to tie those physical elements to the mechanical elements, knowing if we make some improvements in the physical side, what it's going to, what it could potentially do from a mechanical side. And then if I change something mechanically, what's going to be the cascade effect and what do I go to next? So, I mean, talk to me a little bit about like going from the range at PGA National, Bally Bunyan, not knowing what the hell you're doing. Can you give us any like kind of insight as to, you know, not to get real specific, or give us a specific example if you want to, about like, you know, something you might see in a lot of the golfers that come on in, and like, what do you go after first? What, and what are your kind of roadmaps after that? Does that make sense?
Yes. There's a few things I wanted to follow up on, but I'll answer that question. So, you know, part of our swing change philosophy is, you know, we've talked about it in past episodes. You want to start with the true cancer, right? Where do things break down?
All right, we're done with posture, grip alignment. We got all that squared away.
But it's like, let me answer this question in a very roundabout way, which I'm really good at doing.
No doubt you were going to.
You know, one of the questions that Tommy was supposed to ask me, but I think he skipped over, was, you know, why is it important for us to explain this to our students?
I was going to come back to that.
Right. And then that's going to allow me, though, to answer your question on where do I start?
All right. So why is it important that we explain this to our clients and our students?
So number one, this isn't in any order, but I think, you know, it's really powerful for individuals when they're about to not have immediate success, right? And that's where I wanted to highlight and follow up to one thing you said about the guy sitting in there saying, hey, give me the information. You deliver it to me correctly, and I understand it correctly. I interpret it correctly. I have the right intention. My execution will be there, right? And it's funny because in that situation where we talk about, hey, good and bad shots, your biomechanics look the same. Well, I can actually give you a few objectives, give you a few corrections. You get them, understand them, we're on the same page, and the biomechanics still look the same. Are there exceptions? Yes, 11 characteristics. We'll talk about that later, or more so in a future episode. All right, so let's see if I can not get my own self sidetracked here. But yeah, so I wanted to say that one, more people give them, they give themselves more credit than they should. They think that just because they have the information, they can. But another reason we explain that, what our philosophy is, there's a lot of power in when someone knows they're not going to potentially have immediate satisfaction. That's the point I was going to make. That's an example of why we're going to tell people they're not going to have immediate satisfaction. Because in most cases, although we've delivered the information, you're probably not going to execute it because of all the years you've been doing it differently. But, all right, hold on here.
Well, I think just understanding your foundation, your philosophical foundation, you as a coach being able to provide a sound philosophical approach to what you're going to do with them just starts to build that rapport and that trust right out of the gate. You don't know what the hell you're talking about, like early on, you know, you can do a good job to fake it till you make it type of thing, but you can only fake it so long.
It just goes a little bit beyond that. It goes back to that immediate satisfaction and expectations matching reality. We're a long-term development program. So again, I want to say, one, I think it helps analytical minds. If they logically understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, they can connect A to B. They're going to have more patience, more trust. And that's a huge compliment to long-term development, patient and trust. But, you know, you asked, what do you go after first? Well, let's say their takeaway is all sorts of jacked up. Let's say they rotate it wide open. Let's say they disconnect their arms. Now, one thing we haven't unpacked a ton of, you know, we've talked about in past episodes is origin of swing flaws, physical screen. So let's assume that there isn't any major barriers in the physicality, that they can do this. Well, the reality is sometimes, although the takeaway has gotten them out of position, it's putting them out of position at the top, maybe they ripped it inside. A lot of guys that rip the club flat inside and open it, there's a counteracted measurement action, right? It gets heavy, they lift it up, they chuck it over the top. Well, just because we're going to correct the takeaway doesn't mean the over the top is going to be corrected. It's not to say you can't work on them at the same time, but as we know with the deliberate practice and how we all learn, it's best to isolate particular movements and positions until we get those right. So sometimes you might have the conversation with the player that says, hey, we're going to go after your takeaway early on in this process because, yeah, you rotate it wide open and then you chuck it over the top. But the reality is just because we're working on your takeaway doesn't mean the over the top is going to go away. Then the logical question should be like, all right, well, then why are we working on it? Well, due to the fact that a lot of what happens in your downswing as a result to you being out of position right away, I don't want to spend all this time correcting everything that happens after that only for that move to tear down all our work again in the future, right? So when you can sit there and have these conversations with the student, they have an understanding of the big picture, and they're going to allow you to work on a movement, allow you to work on a pattern that's going to better position them, build the foundation in order for you to eliminate variables after the fact, well, then they're going to allow you to do that even though they're not getting immediate satisfaction with a change in ball flight that first lesson. And that's not to say, depending on the time of year and some of the low-hanging fruit, that we can both couple long-term development and some actions we can take to help improve play immediately. There's obviously there's those scenarios. But for the most part, like I said, just because we have the information and we give it to the student and they interpret it correctly and they have the right intention doesn't mean the execution's there. And that's where, again, we'll tie it in at the end, but that's where this swing change philosophy, timing's where it all starts. Tommy, it feeds right into what deliberate practice is, required reading. It feeds right into the loving characteristics, which is, you know, depending on the individual and what they come to the table with, the pace in which this stuff will take effect and what we actually feel comfortable delivering with you at different stages on the timeline. Because if you're younger, 18, hockey player growing up, I'm okay with giving you stuff that might be a little bit different early on in the process, knowing that your likelihood to execute it is greater.
Okay.
Anyway, go ahead. I feel like you want to say something.
But. No, I'm just curious. Maybe I asked a question that was just really challenging to kind of like give it a specific example. So, I mean, all of that makes sense to me. So we understand it's not about having different swings. It's rather about streamlining, you know, the variables that, you know, improve timing and consistency. So do you have some insight or how can golfers work on improving their timing and reducing swing variables?
So number one, I think you should put yourself in front of video and you should grab biomechanical technology. You need to, number one, make sure you're being diagnosed correctly.
Feedback.
Right? So the process is always the same here, like, and it is the same for most coaches, even without the technology, but what is your ball doing? What is the club doing to allow the ball to perform in that manner? What is your body doing biomechanically through the video to allow the club to perform in that manner? And then what's going on in the physical screen that might have lent itself to that movement in the first place? And then you go from there. But I do think you couple that with managing expectations. What is my ultimate goal? Well, if you can buy into the fact and truly understand that the difference between your good and bad shots isn't because you swung differently, but the majority, 99% of your golf swing is identical except the micro movements due to the compensated position you've put yourself in delivery. And then you can understand that position and delivery is compensated because of stuff that you've done prior. And you've approached a mindset of, hey, I need to develop my swing and not fix it and not look for immediate satisfaction and look for paying my dues and putting in the work for a golf swing that'll be long lasting, more simple for me in the end. That would be my recommendation.
Nice. I mean, I think you surmised that pretty well. You know, basically, timing is our philosophy. The less variables there are in the golf swing, the less compensations, the less physical limitations, the easier it is to get people to do things more easily and more consistently, which will make the game more enjoyable and hopefully have them produce some more consistent desired results.
100%. If you wanted to carry it really simple on where we start, though, we start ground up, inside out, so body to arms, start to finish. So yeah, when you're in a long-term development program, we get to start at your address position. Like we talked about in 3 episodes ago, about posture, it's going to be perfect. Next position is going to be as close to perfect based on what you bring to the table physically, and so on. So it's a long-term development goal, objective, in order, yes, you said it perfectly, to make your timing easier to solve. So if I were a listener, I would say, well, what about power? What about speed? Like, well, what I would say is what's cool is when you start to improve a kinematic sequence, sequencing, ground force reaction, how to generate more power correctly, well, your timing is directly influenced 99% of the time in a very positive manner. So if you're generating power efficiently and effectively and in the correct way, your timing is going to get easier for you to repeat too. So those kind of go hand in hand.
Nice. I love all that. Yeah, I don't know if I have any more questions. Do you have any kind of final closing thoughts? I mean, this is a pretty efficient episode, which is fantastic.
We're kind of dumbfounded to look at our podcast and say that, holy cow, it's only been 35 minutes. But I'm good with this. I'll just say this. This is one that we thought about maybe doing earlier on in the launch of this podcast, but I think it's nice to do it when we've done it because it's kind of tied a lot of other episodes together. But this is the basis of it all. And this does stem itself to all these other concepts on the walls within this room that I do want to do the same. I want to go unpack each one of our required readings individually, which could be also a quick little listen. And for all I know, our listeners want to listen to us, but a little less.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's going to be too disappointed with us dragging this out any longer because it is a simple concept, you know? I mean, it takes, you know, what, 5 minutes of our overall assessment that's 2 hours in duration. It's a relatively easily digested concept for people to be like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And again, that develops that initial trust, develops that initial rapport, and helps their mind get into a proper mindset to be able to, you know, start on this journey.
Long-term, development.
I don't think we need to get too far into it.
My hope is that someone can listen to this episode and be like, really admit to themselves that perusing social media and YouTube and trying to find a quick solution to their, you know, whatever perpetual slice/hook just doesn't make sense logically. You've got to look, you got to dig deeper because as much as you might understand the concept, club face, you know, club ball relationship and why the hook might be happening, a lot of the stuff that you're looking at, one, might not pertain to you, but might not be what you should be going after right now. And that's critical.
I wonder if people were expecting something more like mind-blowing that, you know, that's the cornerstone of our entire philosophy and business model.
What are you trying to say? I thought it was mind-blowing.
Simple's better.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? Exactly. So,
was that a tip?
No, the tip, which we have communicated in the past, will continue to repeat over and over and over, which is stop seeking out to fix your game and start seeking out to develop your game.
By simplifying your timing equation and eliminating variables. Get this.
Cheers. Bow.
A big thank you for tuning in to another episode of Everything But the Tip podcast. Stay connected with us on all social media platforms by following @SmartGolfFitness. For additional episodes, updates, and exclusive content, check out our website at smartgolffitness.com. Don't forget to show some love, like, share, and subscribe to ensure you never miss out on the latest insights and engaging discussions. Your support means the world to us. Until next time, keep swinging and stay fit.